Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Heather Copelson about her recent book, Faithful Bodies, Performing Religion and Race in the Puritan Atlantic, which examines the intersection between religious practices and racial identities among a number of groups, primarily in colonial New England and Bermuda. Heather, thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let's just kind of get started on how you got into this project, what led you to this, and what you were kind of curious about when investigating it.
Sure. Well, the very beginnings of the project are way back when I was in graduate school. My advisor told me I should really think about where I wanted to spend time. And I was already interested in religion and Puritans and race. And so he suggested, look at Ireland, because there were Puritans there and they haven't been quite as studied as the ones in New England, and look at Bermuda. And so I started looking into it and got very interested in the fact that Bermuda had no indigenous population, and that there was slavery there, but it seemed to have a different character than in other places in the Americas. But then also on a more practical note, as I was talking to friends and family and colleagues about this, they all said, "Oh, well, you know, Bermuda has much better weather, so I think really you should go to Bermuda." And I have, on the whole, I have found that to be true, although that first trip in February when it was dreadfully cold and damp and cold in the archives, I was thinking, I don't know that the weather is so different. but location aside, what really interested me was that, so here is a place, a colony, a place that's still a colony, where slavery was integral and central to the way society operated, but in fact that seemed to have racial categories that were working out differently and that had a strong Puritan influence in the beginning, but then church organization went somewhat the opposite direction that it did in New England. So New England, you end up with a strong sense of congregations all being individual, and in Bermuda, they end up deciding that they want to have some kind of presbytery, some kind of overarching system. And there was also the colonial sources for Bermuda were really concise, and it's a small enough amount of material that it's possible for the 17th century to really feel like you can read most of what's out there. And some of that, of course, is a sad thing for historians, because the proprietary company that was the Summers Island Company that ran Bermuda for the first part of its existence, their papers were probably intentionally destroyed during a dispute over the island's charter. And so sad for historians, but I guess good for whoever was trying to conceal the books at the time. But that means that the colonial records are really a lot of them are just in the Bermuda archives. There are also some things in the Public Record Office in England, and it's a project that it's possible to have a read through records. They weren't destroyed by hurricanes or floods as in many other places, and really try and get a sense of what were people doing and what were they getting in trouble for, and to look for religion outside of church meetings, because that was really one of my main interests. And the, the New England, of course, has been very well studied and continues to be intriguing to people. And I was really pulled to try and figure out what the Puritans thought they were doing, but also what they did and how their actions really showed their ideas about human difference. So both what we think about what we think about now as race, and then religious differences and how that overlapped with geography and people's sense of distance and really where their place in the world.
That's a really good starting place, and I wonder if you could say just a bit more about Bermuda in terms of what it's like as a colony. You took a few steps talking about that at the beginning, but because this is a podcast around Caribbean studies, there's some interesting parallels and differences between Bermuda and what's traditionally thought as kind of the more traditional Lesser Antilles and Greater Antilles. So what makes Bermuda unique? What are some of the similarities with the Caribbean? And if you could just sort of describe what that society was like.
Well, what makes it, I don't know about unique, but I would say unusual, is that it's, and not only its geographic location and that it is isolated in terms of distance from other land, it's, now I'm forgetting the exact number of nautical miles, but we'll say roughly 600, I think. Although ocean currents, of course, meant that travel, much of maritime travel came near Bermuda and used Bermuda as a turning point if they didn't run onto the reefs, because it's a very low-lying island. But this was, so it's founded as a colony quite early for the English, late for other European powers, but in the scheme of English colonization, it's pretty early. And it's quite successful relatively quickly. And in part because of the people that, the Indians and Africans that the early English colonizers bring from the Caribbean. So there are Caribbean ties right from the beginning. And the knowledge of, for instance, how to plant tobacco and harvest it and cure it is really key to Bermuda's 17th century economic success. And that initial knowledge, the records show that it comes largely from Africans who are brought from somewhere in the Caribbean. And as Bermuda develops as an English colony, those ties really continue so that they survive. There's this initial period of isolation where the proprietary company, the Summers Island Company, that's run back in London, they try to keep the islanders isolated from others, but there are always some comings and goings. And then once the company period ends at the end of the 17th century, certainly it ties along the Circum-Caribbean are essential to Bermuda's economy and society. And so that in terms of material goods, for instance, you find a lot of similar material goods. I would say what's different from a lot of the Caribbean colonies is that the racial makeup, the demographic, is quite different. So that it's only in the mid-18th century that, I think it's 1730s is when you first get a 30% of the population being of African descent. And it only reaches, it barely reaches 50% by the end of the 18th century. So that's quite different from, say, Barbados, which is, 80% by the late 17th century. So slavery is very much, and racial slavery is very much a part of the island, but as I said, the demographics are very different.
Mm-hmm. And so you use Bermuda as a kind of a contrast and a comparison to New England. And one of the things I really liked about the book is you have these early chapters that have a very refined examination of non-European religious practices. So would you mind telling us a little bit about the Tayano and Algonquin and West African rituals that are important in these colonial religious traditions?
Sure. It's drawing on, you know, a lot of thinking about the really the similarities among all these peoples in the 17th century and before, even as I was trying to delineate the real differences that there were, but that for all of the people, that other than human beings, unseen beings of one kind or another, were very important in their lives in different ways. And so a lot of what I do in the first few chapters is really try to establish that worldview. So to think about, for instance, the religious importance of crystals for Southern Algonquins, and so why crystals were seen as a means to access other than human powers or games of chance, you know, how that was a way for men especially to demonstrate that they were able to access and harness the power and influence of other than human beings to win at games of chance. And then for the Taino, thinking about the geography, you know, that certain that places have geographic power, that objects that are shiny and that have come from far away are also representative and embodiments of power of one kind or another. And that, for instance, the one of the things I talk a lot about are semi figures that are not only, I think some European sources describe them as idols, but really they're ways of giving a body in the present to this community member who now exists in this different form. And has powers that people who are just in the land of the living that most of them can't access. And so what I did in each of these cases was really try to think about the material items and then just the actions that people took to try and access the powers of these beings and to really cross the threshold from the world of the living into the world of what has been called the spirits, although spirits have connotations that I try to avoid.
And how does the part of the title of your book is Faithful Bodies, and so the body is really important, not just in those non-European practices, but also when you're discussing the Puritans. And so before we get to the Puritans, I wonder if you could talk maybe just a little bit about how the body figures into some of these non-European traditions, and then sort of why you think it's important to reorient our understanding towards the considerations of bodies when we're thinking about religion.
Yeah. Oh, and one thing I meant to say about Southern Algonquins is that wampum, for instance, wampum was both used once Europeans came as a currency, but was representative of temporal power and the resources it took to create beads out of the linings of shells, but then also had spiritual power in and of itself. And so thinking about the different meanings of wampum to various Southern Algonquian peoples. And so in terms of the body, thinking about the body both as the human body, with flesh and bones, and then really trying to link that to and understand different ways of seeing the community body. So that the community is a group of individuals acting together or against each other, but that how they think of themselves as a group is often filtered through ideas about the physical body. And then, for instance, in the first chapter, I also think about geography. So homeland as linked to different parts of the body. Thinking about, so certain caves where the Tainan came out of, you know, that those were parts of the body of the island, and that their political organization was arranged based on thinking of Hispaniola as an island, as a body, you know, so that there's a spine and there are limbs and there's a head and eyes. I'm sorry. So that was what else did you ask?
I think it just kind of get us into a conversation around this idea of the body and how it relates to religious practice. And I guess maybe the second part of the question, I apologize if I cut you off on the earlier question, was just why you think maybe we need to have more of a reorientation towards a consideration of the body. And if you think that's not really represented properly when people talk about colonial religion or these early American traditions, is the body not really present as much as it should be in scholarly examinations of religion?
I think in the last, you know, 5 and 10 years, it's very much more present. When I was beginning my research, what I was thinking about was, well, you know, everybody has bodies. And in fact, the Puritans are pretty earthy about the way they think. I mean, they're not trying to deny the existence of the human body, but really to harness it in what they thought was a godly path, was God's idea of order for the world. But a lot of what scholarship, or the I would say not the popular idea of Puritans is, I think, still often, you know, that they hated the body, they hated sex, they just, you know, were killjoys in every way. And so to really think about religion as more than these sermons that were printed by, were published by a few ministers, and to think of how people who, you know, maybe didn't even always make it to meeting on Sunday, thought about their relationship with other than human beings, or that with deities that they could not see, but that whose presence they were always trying to discern. And so, thinking about the impact of that presence on their bodies, their human bodies. So I think there's been a lot of work, I would say, recently on that, but it hasn't quite filtered into kind of popular ideas about colonial religion, if we take that to be the European side. And then what I was seeing a lot of was people would analyze the body or material goods more in relation to natives or Africans or people who were not of European descent. And then Europeans would get this very more word and book based analysis of their theology and their dogma. And then that was especially true of people looking at Protestants, you know, so they're, you know, and it's the people of the word. So, okay, Catholics have rituals. We can talk about those. But for the Protestants, let's talk about all these sermons that were printed. But they're really in terms of how religion made a difference in religious belief ended up affecting their worlds was through actions, you know, through bodies and movements and what they did or didn't do throughout the day. And so I was trying to figure out a wider part of Puritan experience, and then also to think about all the peoples in the Americas on a more, in similar ways, rather than saying, all right, the non-Europeans get the body and they're physical creatures, and the Europeans, especially the Puritans, you know, they're trying to deny the body, so we're just going to talk about, you know, their intellectual ideas. So it's to try and get away from that.
And try to level those experiences a little bit.
Right.
So before we get into kind of intersection between these different groups, maybe you just say a little bit more. You sort of started talking about the Puritans and the ways that they have a kind of corporeal sense about religion. And so you talk about not just kind of the body as it relates to certain traditions within Puritan practice, but also concepts around the body of Christ and the body politic. And so could you sketch that out just a little bit before we start talking about how that then gets applied to conversion?
Yeah. So the body of Christ was really still at the center of Puritan life. I mean, they did not, their most important ritual was the Lord's Supper, or, you know, the meal commemorating Jesus's last meal with the disciples. And they didn't believe that the substance of the meal, you know, the wine and the bread was, or whatever they might be eating, was sacred in and of itself. But that, in fact, it could focus their meditation on God, and so that the physical parts of the ritual and the actions were, in fact, important, even as they were saying that the ritual wasn't the biggest deal, it still mattered to them. They still thought that, for instance, silver would make, when possible, made a more appropriate vessel for this meal, to drink the wine, or for this meal, than wood. And so it's the idea that there are disparate members of a community who are brought together and then transformed through their belief, through their conversion, which I guess is maybe in getting into your next question a little bit. But that part of being Christian is undergoing this transformation, so that you are no longer only an individual, but that you are part of this larger body that is both the gathered congregation of your immediate local community, and then this very geographically disparate community of Protestants. So that the body of Christ is not just the people you see around you every day or on a weekly basis, but really people who are also other Christians. I don't know if that, I feel like I might have missed some of your questions.
Oh, no, that's a good way to kind of think about the Puritan aspect of this. So then let's kind of join these two groups together, the non-Europeans and the European Puritans. And so obviously conversion is a big part of this, and concepts about, you know, are non-Europeans appropriate members of the body of Christ? That's where you kind of see ideas about the body coming out, especially in your text. But let's just talk about maybe how initially optimistic white settlers were, both in New England and also in Bermuda, about the chances of converting indigenous and African people.
Well, they thought that if they were properly instructed, that you know, of course, they would see the superiority of what the colonists were trying to teach them, and would strive to avoid eternal damnation, and to discern themselves as one of, you know, one of the ones whom God had saved, and that there was also, I mean, many, you know, sometimes people they encountered did show interest, either because of previous contact with Europeans, or they were interested in other aspects of contact with the English and with other Europeans, so material goods, for instance, or, you know, that for some people it meant being able, you know, a lot of peoples were in, you know, were coming through various population crises, you know, that it was a way, becoming Christian might offer an avenue to adding on another means of organizing community. And so that was the other thing, that missionary work from the English did not look the same as it did, you know, from, say, the Jesuits, but it also was not entirely absent. So that they were interested in it, and were the other thing that I was that started me on this project was really thinking about Certainly religion has been used as an excuse for lots of violence and oppression, but to also think about, well, you know, if we take people as sincere in aspects of their belief, how does that motivate them? And how does that alter the way or affect the way they see the world? And so if we think about it from that sense, that, you know, the Puritans did want to convert others. They wanted to convert natives. They wanted to convert Africans. And in Bermuda, what you see, because lifespans were relatively long, and you had multi-generational families relatively early, and there was not as much, say, selling enslaved people away, that people over time did become familiar with Christianity and were familiar with the practices and seemed to have taken them on and made them part of their own practice.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, this as with all religions, when you get these collisions of culture, these syncretisms of culture, they get adapted and adopted in certain ways. And so what were the ways in which indigenous people, both in Bermuda and also in New England, and also West Africans that came over, how did they adapt and adopt these Christian practices? Do you see a lot of variation? To what degree were they kind of reflecting the types of practices that the Puritans wanted them to reflect?
Well, some of the material practices, we found out about through archaeological work. So one that I opened the book with was there was a meeting house of praying Indians. So Indians who declared themselves Christian, and some of them, at least the English, also acknowledged as Christian. So they had a meeting house, and in the corner there was there were crystals buried there, which indicates that so that was seen as a spiritually powerful substance, so that they were combining practices that they had had before Christianity with new Christian practices. And so it's not, what I try to do in the book is not to say, okay, well, one is more authentic than the other, but to really think about how people just navigated their way through religious practice, some of which were new to them and some of which, their communities or versions of their communities had been engaging in from time immemorial. So that the crystals, I think, are a really powerful example, because it's certainly something that had, say, one of the Puritan missionaries known about, he would have been, John Eliot, or Daniel Gookin. They had these well-known missionaries who would have been aghast at the idea that the praying Indians were still burying crystals in their meeting houses. But looking at it from the point of view of those native individuals, and they were Christian, they prayed with Gookin, they followed it, and they also were calling, and so the meeting house was a place of gathering that held a lot of spiritual power. And so the crystal was one way to try and focus that and really even intensify it. So that's one example. And then in terms of, and initially in Bermuda, the Central African, West Central African influence is stronger. So you see some of the early Africans who were brought to the island are Catholic. So that they're, especially if they came from, the Congo, that they are Congolese Catholic. Various godparenting ceremonies that were more similar to things that happened in, say, a Catholic context. But then you also see baptisms of of people of African descent in Bermuda that are recorded in the church records, as you do in New England. So those are some of the ways. And then in terms of how, say, the English were affected, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the third chapter, which is really thinking about the Lord's Supper, so this important Christian meal, and then the substance, you know, what was the bread? You know, what actually was the substance that made up the physical bread that people ate? So in Bermuda, they end up using cassava to make bread rather than, say, wheat flour. And cassava had, for indigenous peoples of the Caribbean, had, you know, was an important food and often had spiritual meaning, or was seen as a gift from either the gods or an important hero figure. And so once the English are using that cassava to make bread to be eaten at this central religious ritual, even if they didn't think of themselves as being affected by their environment, they were.
So then as these adaptations are occurring, and as natives and Africans are coming over to the Puritan fold, what started to reduce the Puritans' level of comfort with evangelizing to those groups? Where do you start to see some limitations in their desirability? Where do you see some sort of fractures in sort of how they're seeing this conversion come about?
It's overlapping with other areas of life. So you get, you know, the level of violence makes a difference, and then this an idea, the increasing idea that religion, that even changing bodily practices is not enough. So ideas that inherit, that certain characteristics are going to be inherited along with skin color and are not changeable, that's part of what starts to affect them. And Bermuda is also another interesting reason that it's intriguing to me, was that their laws about, say, interracial marriage don't mention, the regulation of unlawful sex don't mention religion as really a category that's attached to or expressed as race, the way that, say, a lot of the laws in many Caribbean colonies do, in the English Caribbean colonies do, so that the law against bastardy in Bermuda doesn't mention race. You know, so it doesn't separate out interracial sex as a separate category until 1723. And even then, they don't conflate Christians with whites. And so in Bermuda, the difference seems to be that as you know, as the economics of the island shift, and then religion starts to be, it's still important, but it's not seen as something that needs to organize and affect the state in quite the same prescriptive way, that's an element that starts to make for less acceptance. And then in New England, I mean, it's repeated frustration from the English side. So aside from the wars and violence, which are certainly significant things, that repeated frustration that they're, you know, these natives were still not practicing Christianity and didn't look like and didn't act like the English in all the same ways, or all the ways that they thought they should. And so that's, I guess, the kind of big scale, or would it be, well, the broad answer.
Well, we can get into the specifics too, if you want. I mean, one of the things you talk about is how important something like King Philip's War is to to changing attitudes. And you know, you certainly have this idea that there are these divergent attitudes towards race between New England and Bermuda. And part of it is, I think you claim that religious divisions, as they become less pronounced, racial exclusion becomes more aggressive. And so maybe you could chart out some of the specifics that allow that to happen, and also the broad issues. But how do these religious transformations start to correlate with changing attitudes towards race?
Well, with King Philip's War, and you on both sides, or let's see this, it's not just English versus the Indians, but by the end, both natives and the English, most of them seem to feel that. Or see the events of King Philip's War in the aftermath as proving that there is not going to be peaceful intermingling and accommodation, because the English do things like corral allied natives and praying Indians and put them on the desolate island where there's the middle of Boston Harbor, where there's no way for them to get food, and only kind of calling some of them off when they need them to serve as spies and guides. The acting out of these assumptions that English acting upon assumptions that, okay, the natives are not like the English, they can never be, and they're always going to be dangerous and treacherous. Acting out on those ideas really separates. They start to implement even more legal separations and limit. Say, for instance, that Indians cannot go into town and cannot carry arms and all of these other kinds of restrictions. Because the other thing that's happening too is that. As a religious idea that everyone is sinful and is only saved through the grace of God, as that starts not to affect or the ideal is no longer that should directly affect laws and the ordering of other kind of earthly areas of life decreases, then you start to see class. Wealth divisions and these developing racial divisions come to the fore, and the idea that excluding people who are not like you is the way to go. And so if religion, from the English viewpoint, if the body of Christ is no longer what really is supposed to shape everything about community, if that transformation is no longer possible, then all these other barriers remain in place and in fact become more important. And so you also see it with Europeans and English even, who are not Puritan. So with the Quakers have different ideas about community in the body that don't line up very well with Puritan ideas. And then you have Europeans like the Irish who, many of them are Catholic, and so there's the ideas about Irish Catholics in New England or in Bermuda, for the few who are recorded there, that you see again these ideas about people who cannot be incorporated into the community, into the body of the politic, because if the body politic, so this. The political organization of the community is no longer so closely tied to the body of Christ, which holds the potential for transformation, you end up with something that is more static or where those human differences are stronger. I don't know that actually had more detail. It's still fairly abstract, but.
Well, that's why people need to read the book, right? Get all those juicy details in. I just kind of want to close with maybe the last section where you're talking about laws around interracial sex and It's a topic that I'm pretty interested in. And so I know you touched on it already, but it's a really interesting study of how attitudes towards interracial sex, especially in Bermuda, really transform. And so if you could maybe just kind of chart the chronology of how that happens in Bermuda, because in some ways it encapsulates a lot of the ideas you're talking about throughout the book in terms of how a kind of religious tolerance transforms into maybe a later intolerance, and how that has a correlation with certain attitudes towards race. So if you wouldn't mind kind of summarizing that last section of the book where you discuss those laws about interracial relationships.
Yeah, and definitely, yeah, it's something that is actually, in a way, I wouldn't say the part that I worked on the longest, but I guess that was the first really big, that was my first big foray into the Bermuda archives and getting into those records and really thinking about the fact that abominable to reference, so that unlawful sex was described as abominable in lots of records, and then for instance in a lot of other literature what happens is people say, well, okay, interracial sex is described as abominable, so that means that interracial sex is seen as this especially terrible thing because of ideas about the inferiority of some groups of humans. But in Bermuda, it's really what's very clear, and then on reflection makes it clear that that's what's happening in other places as well, is that abominable is just, it's used for all unlawful sex, so all sex outside marriage, no matter who is engaging in it. And that for Bermuda, the other thing that's notable is that one kind of unlawful sex does not seem to really be worse than another. So you don't get language about defilement when there's, say, an English man and an African woman the way you do in Virginia, for example. And so that intrigued me and made me start counting some things about which cases were appeared and how were people described and when there were outcomes of the case, what happened. And so what I saw was that for much of the 17th century, unlawful sex was not really punished. Interracial sex, unlawful sex was not really punished more harshly than other kinds. That interracial marriages were in fact recognized by officials on multiple occasions, because interracial marriage was better than having people live together and under the sin of fornication. And you also, one of the changes that happens is initially there are lots of charges of fornication, so of sex outside marriage, and some bastardy cases, so some cases where there is a child born. And then over time, those simple fornication cases drop out and it becomes more about just the bastardy cases. So there seems to be more of an emphasis on, okay, what's going to happen with property. But you still don't see all that much more of, the interracial cases are not seen to be qualitatively worse. And then what starts to happen, so in other colonies, you get laws where, say, unlawful sex, where the people involved are of different races, are punished more harshly. And that separation does not happen in Bermuda. I mean, what happened, there's an effective difference in that people who are able to pay a fine instead of being whipped are more likely to be white than free than not. But there were, for instance, white servant women who were convicted of fornication with a man of African descent who were not able to pay the fine and so were whipped. And then what you start to see in the early 18th century is that white women are, several are able to pay their fines and not be whipped and actually pay their fines repeatedly for partners, for relations with partners often of the same name. So as far as I can tell, with the same partner. And that seems to be what eventually spurs the change in the law in 1723, where if where interracial fornication, then no longer a person who's convicted of that, a white person who's convicted of that, no longer has the option to pay a fine instead of being whipped. They have to be whipped. The other thing that's really different about Bermuda is that there are cases where white men are convicted of fornication with women of color. And that's not, I haven't done in-depth research in other colonies records, but judging from the literature, that's really quite unusual. And so that's something that does drop out over time, is the idea of the religiously driven ideal of everyone being restricting sex to marriage, as that is no longer enforced so much in the courts, then cases of white men and women of color no longer appear in the courts. And you get, say, women of color charged with bastardy, but without any partner being charged with anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get to just talk about your new project, which is really fascinating, but I want to make sure that if there was something that you wanted to talk about with the book that I didn't quite cover. There's a lot in here and a lot to the sex. So is there anything that we've missed that you wanted to cover?
No, I think, as I mentioned, one of the things that I really enjoyed writing a lot, even though it came quite late in the process of writing the book, was really thinking through those different grains that make up bread, right? So the meaning of wheat and the meaning of maize. And so it's meaning in terms of religious practice, but then also that very tactile sense of how is it different to eat something that does not have gluten versus something that that does. And then finding that there was all this, Puritan ministers had written about the difference between, I think it's Edward Taylor is the heaven's, Christ's heaven sugar cake. I'm not quoting that properly, but basically the idea that Christ is like eating this cake out of amazing white flour, fine wheat flour, as opposed to coarser, heavier grains, and so really just kind of being tickled with the with the idea that obviously it's a very different time, and even the grains themselves would have been different, and yet there is still very much a difference between eating, say, a baked good that is made out of one kind of one substance versus another. So thinking about how our bodily experiences, as much as they are always culturally determined, there are at the root are some physical differences. And so thinking about the play between cultural difference and then what is physical and so that gets back to then the idea of, everybody has a body and that starts their interaction with the world, but how each culture understands that body in relation to the world can be very different. So even though the body's a universal, it's always all particular.
Yeah, that I found that really interesting as well. Could you say a few words about your new project? I know you're kind of busily starting it right now, and you've kind of just come from a short research trip. So what are you working on next?
I'm looking at cultural exchange through music and dance and public processions across the Americas. So I'm trying to take this pretty narrow range of experience, of practice, of action, but try to be very broad in terms of geography and of culture. And so I want to keep it early modern in the European sense, keep it 16th and 17th century, not to focus on trying to find the first contact between a given indigenous people and Europeans or Africans and Europeans, but to really think about, all right, in this world where there are different kinds of contacts, and some people have contact through material goods and some people have face-to-face, how do music and dance, these experiences that even when they're right in front of us are hard to put into words, and how can we think about that as an archive? So often what we have are descriptions, say, by European travelers, but there are also archaeological records of instruments. There's musicological work on, okay, what were instruments made of? How would that have affected their sound? But I have to say, so this part of it was actually sparked by something very pop culture, which was, I was watching So You Think You Can Dance a couple summers.
That's a great route for new ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
Circle scholarship, yeah.
And one of the commentators, one day they have guest judges, was clearly moved in different ways by various performances, but could not articulate it. Could really just say that he really liked the way they moved, or they had a lot of energy. And then the next time there was somebody who was very articulate, even when it was of a different dance tradition, so that she could talk about ways the body was moving or hinging or what a joint was doing or things like that, that translated that movement into words. But that got me started thinking about, so it's difficult even when it's in front of us, even if it's you're trained in a particular tradition, how much more is that, is there translation and incomprehension going on when it's different traditions, and when the person writing the description is not necessarily interested in being detailed about, say, physical motions or sounds. And there's a lot of growing scholarship, historical scholarship on sensory, on the senses and how they change over time and from culture to culture. So what it means right now is I'm reading a lot of 16th, what I was just reading was 16th and 17th century treatises on dancing and ballet. And one of them was a German treatise against dancing. So dancing as the root of many evils because it allows for the touching of bodies between men and women. And I was telling a friend, and he said, oh, so basically the plot of Footloose.
Well, I hope there's like a Kevin Bacon-esque character that 16th century German text.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. And I think it actually connects really well with what you're talking about in Faithful Bodies. So it sounds like a great jumping off point from where you just came from. Well, I really enjoyed this book and I really enjoyed talking to you about it. And thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I had fun.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.